Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim in our next Economist Mom segment. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. President Trump issued his $4.7 trillion budget proposal this week for fiscal year 2020, which is something we will discuss in more detail later in the show. For now, here are some of the highlights of that proposal. There would be roughly a 5% increase in military spending, not by dramatically increasing budget caps, but by actually circumventing them. The proposal channels $165 billion into a war-related account that is exempt from spending limits. Military spending would then total $750 billion for that fiscal year. Taking a closer look would reveal that some areas of non-defense spending would get hit especially hard. The EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers would each face cuts of 30%. The State Department and International Assistance Programs would be cut by 24%. The Transportation Department would be cut by 19%, the Department of Housing and Urban Development by 18%, and the Department of Health and Human Services would be cut by 12%. Other agencies would see funding boosts. For example, Veterans Affairs would get a 7.5% increase. Border wall funding would increase again, this time by $8.6 billion. That includes $5 billion from the Department of Homeland Security and $3.6 billion from military construction accounts. With Democrats staunchly opposed to a wall, the request could set the stage for another government shutdown this fall. The budget doesn't balance under the president's proposal, but it projects reducing deficits from $1.1 trillion in fiscal year 2020 to roughly $202 billion by fiscal year 2029. Achieving those figures requires very strong economic growth assumptions by the administration, as the plan forecasts a much rosier economy than most others do. The president's proposal assumes growth will stay at about 3% through 2024, which translates into an additional $2.8 trillion in revenue over the coming decade compared to other forecasts. Later fiscal years would see deeper cuts, trimming $2.8 trillion in planned spending for non-defense discretionary programs, healthcare programs, welfare programs, and federal student loan programs. Temporary rate reductions in the 2017 tax cuts would be made permanent, but revenue is still projected to rise from $3.6 trillion in fiscal year 2020 to $6.3 trillion in fiscal year 2029 under the plan. Even still, the debt would grow. Debt held by the public would increase by about 47% over the decade, from $16.9 trillion this fiscal year to $24.8 trillion in fiscal year 2029. All of this to still say the president's proposal is likely dead on arrival. Democrats have panned it, and Republican appropriators have declined to endorse it, saying it needs further review. Plus, congressional leaders have acknowledged the need to raise discretionary spending limits to get any kind of budget deal in place. In an effort to reduce friction in the 2020 budget process, House Democrats plan to write a budget blueprint that avoids calling for Medicare for All or enacting a Green New Deal, but it will call for policies aimed at improving the Obama administration's health care overhaul and allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices. In fact, Democrats have already introduced legislation that would allow Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs in an effort to lower drug costs. A new bill with 118 Democratic co-sponsors would allow Medicare to negotiate directly with drug manufacturers. If the government and drug makers fail to agree on a price, the government would award a license to manufacture a drug to a company that was willing to sell it at the government's desired price. Some Republicans have strongly criticized the proposal, saying it could amount to confiscation of intellectual property. Up next, economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby, for the next edition of our Economist Mom segment. We'll be talking about the president's fiscal year 2020 budget proposal in more detail. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group and is joining us for our recurring Economist Mom segment. Diane and Bob are regular contributors on the show. Welcome back.
Thanks, Chase.
Good to be back.
This week, I thought it would be timely to discuss the president's budget proposal. It's all that's in the news right now, or maybe not all that's in the news, but it is a dominant issue right now. And before we get into the details, I wanted to take a step back and look at the process as a whole and get an understanding of what the budget proposal by the president is meant to even communicate. So, Diane, can you give us a quick rundown on what presidential budget proposals are typically meant to communicate and where they fall in the annual appropriations or budget process?
Yeah, sure. So the president has his chance to, and together with his administration, has a chance with the budget to present their ideas, their kind of policy wish list to Congress, basically. So it's sort of the opening. It's a starting point for the administration to communicate what areas of the government budget they want expanded, what they want contracted, how they want to change tax policy or keep tax policy the same. They use their own economic assumptions. They define how they're measuring the effects of their policies that they propose on the budget according to their own starting point, or what we call a baseline. And so sometimes it gets confusing to talk about what the president is proposing and how it compares to current law, because of the fact that Congressional Budget Office, who's the official scorekeeper of tax and spending proposals for Congress, Congressional Budget Office starts from a current law baseline, but the presidential administration typically starts from a different baseline, which usually is arranged in some way that happens to understate the costs of their proposals, because that's the most politically convenient position to take. So it is not like it's not a bill that's going to Congress. It's a much weaker document than that. It is just sort of the administration suggesting some policy ideas and waiting to see how Congress receives those ideas. So members of the administration will go before House and Senate committees, congressional committees, over the next couple weeks, and they'll have a chance to talk about specific areas of the budget. So, for example, the Treasury Secretary will talk a lot about tax policy with the House Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee. And they'll get a chance to discuss the proposals in further detail to the extent that detail exists. And that's a starting point. The hope from the administration is always that, oh, Congress will hear about these ideas of theirs and say, hey, that's a great idea. Let's introduce a bill. Let's work on a bill and work on language, legislative language with the White House, and let's introduce a bill of our own in Congress.
Diane, you mentioned that this is sort of a starting point for policy discussions, or it can be, and it can be also relatively disconnected from, say, economic or fiscal baselines that exist according to current law, as opposed to just policy trends. Can you paint a picture for our listeners of the backdrop right now, fiscally and economically, that this proposal is plopping right in the middle of?
Well, a big, you know, one of the major pieces of legislation in terms of the federal budget was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was passed in December of 2017. And because that is, it was kind of a prime example of how members of Congress and the administration, they work with a 10-year budget window, and oftentimes they try to hold down the cost of a proposal by letting certain features or the whole proposal expire within the 10-year budget window. So that had happened with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, is that a lot of the individual income tax cuts in the law were scheduled to expire after a few years. And that is an example of a policy that CBO would literally count as having expired when they do their baseline budget outlook. But the administration, who wants to extend those tax cuts, includes the cost of extending those tax cuts in their baseline because they want to think of that as already built in. That's a policy that's already passed. Of course, it's going to get extended, is what they'd like to think. And so we're not going to count that as any new proposal to just extend the existing tax cuts, whereas CBO would count the cost of extending the tax cuts in an evaluation of the cost of the president's budgetary proposals. So we would see something quite different when CBO comes out with their analysis in terms of, you know, the administration saying there's no cost of extending the tax cuts, but CBO will probably say there's $1 trillion cost of extending the tax cuts. So that's quite a big difference in the 10-year budget window. So that's an example. CBO is wedded to current law, literal current law. So if things expire, CBO has to assume they do indeed expire.
And Diane, one other question I had before we jump into the details of this year's proposal, going back to this sort of being the starting block for the process or even the policy discussion, in the past, have presidential budget proposals always been disconnected from sort of our economic and fiscal realities, or have we been just sort of migrating down that path in recent administrations where they've become more and more unrealistic because they're more of a political document than a functional one?
I don't know how to answer that question in terms of economic assumptions. I think every administration has an incentive to paint a rosy scenario in terms of economics when it comes to presenting their policy ideas. So I don't know that it's gotten worse intentionally over time. I think there's always been the incentive to have rosier economic scenarios that support your policy ideas and make them look like they have more economic benefit than that might be realistic. So it's not unusual for administration economic assumptions to deviate considerably from congressional, the CBO's economic assumptions. Policy-wise, I mean, it can be a more or not so much of a partisan document. Maybe in past administrations, there was more of a genuine effort to put out a budget that the administration actually had a chance of influencing congressional proposals. This document feels a little bit like, you know, right out of the block. It seems like a lot of Republicans in Congress aren't exactly embracing the big pieces of this budget and the general policy stance, which is to cut, discretionary spending by quite a bit and to even cut some of the programs that I think a lot of congressional Republicans assumed President Trump was not going to be go after, Medicare or Medicaid. It might be that I think I'm hearing some pushback already. So, that probably has varied across administrations. How much is this a genuine effort to reach out to Congress and say, hey, we have some ideas and we think you'd be interested in them, versus, hey, we're going to do the exact opposite of what you guys in Congress are doing and we're going to say, use our budget document to show you that we are not in line with you and we don't really want your ideas. We want to see our own ideas go through. I think that this may be a little bit more of a, there may be more partisanship in terms of the policy proposals built into this presidential budget.
So, Bob, this might be a good time to transition to discussing this year's or fiscal year 2020's budget proposal by the president, and maybe you can communicate to our listeners some of the highlights of the proposal, maybe some of the actual facts and figures or new initiatives that the president is putting out there as this sort of starting point for Congress.
Well, there are a couple of really important things about the budget. The first is, as Diane mentioned, it's advisory, so we hear a lot about the budget, but it's not something that will go to Congress as a bill. It's just the president's way of saying these are my priorities on spending and taxes. In this case, the the budget relies, well, for one thing, the goal that they've set is to achieve balance within 15 years. So it's a long-term, slow-moving goal to get back to balance by 2034, which is about the time, by the way, that the Social Security Trust Fund goes bankrupt. I don't think those two things have much in common, but, I mean, it just struck me as an interesting juxtaposition. But anyway, that's a, you know, it will strike many people as not a very ambitious goal, but, I mean, it's, given where we are now, it's a perfectly reasonable goal. It's an economically achievable goal. The way they have gone about doing it is not realistic. And so you hear a lot of talk about the budget being dead on arrival, which is true, but that's true with most presidential budgets. I think the things that stand out to me are, first, the so-called baseline on which it's assumed is based on very, very robust economic growth, and the feedback effect that they assume that that has in turn on revenues. So this has a very optimistic view of both economic growth and revenues. Higher economic growth projections than most neutral forecasters like the Congressional Budget Office or the Federal Reserve are projecting. You know, they're thinking about 3%, that magic 3% real, not, you know, inflation-adjusted economic growth, pretty much throughout the 10-year window. And most forecasters, including CBO, think that the current sugar high from the tax cuts is going to wear off, and it's already beginning to wear off. You're seeing that in the numbers. And that economic growth is going to be not only below 3%, but possibly below 2% when you get out, you know, beyond the next couple of years. So the first thing to think about these numbers is that they rely on a pretty optimistic assumption of economic growth. Secondly, there are a lot of spending cuts here that they rely upon that, you know, that we anticipate probably won't happen, but let me focus on one part of it, those are the discretionary spending cuts. You know, we've talked about discretionary spending a lot, and that's about that one-third of the budget that is governed by the annual appropriations bills. And what the administration is proposing is basically to give defense a boost, and there'll probably be some bipartisan support for that, but to cut very substantially the non-defense discretionary programs, and that will fly in the face of what the Democrats' priorities are. And the non-defense cuts are quite substantial. It's like about $1 trillion over the 10-year budget window. And I look at the, I mean, they're projecting that we would actually, in dollar terms, be spending less money 10 years from now on the non-defense discretionary budget than we are now. And that's not a realistic assumption. And so you get what I would call phantom savings from assuming this $1 trillion worth of savings. So you might get, putting those two things together, you might get like a $1 trillion boost from the assumed economic growth and $1 trillion from assumed non-defense discretionary savings. And, you know, so the budget numbers might be off rather substantially, and that would indicate that the budget probably wouldn't balance even by 2034.
Bob, you mentioned the rosy economic scenario that's sort of cooked into this proposal. How is the administration making the jump to sustaining 3% economic growth when most other experts or analysis from, say, the CBO sees us tapering off to around, you know, 1.7%. Is it simply just to make the numbers work, or are they relying on some kind of shift in policy or even demographics that might say, yeah, we can sustain 3%?
Well, Chase, you just have to believe.
I mean,
ye of little faith. Let me just say, I mean, Diane can weigh in on this too, but I mean, basically, they've got their story and they're sticking to it, which is that they believe that the tax cut that was enacted in 2017 is not just going to juice up the economy in the short term, but over the long term. And, you know, that's a theory yet to be proved.
And, you know, one thing that CBO does in there, you know, if you look at, if you compare the administration's assumptions for GDP growth compared to CBO's, you know, administration's almost double the growth rate. But, you know, one thing that CBO does is they do try to be somewhat conservative in their growth estimates, but and they try to take into account that there are business cycles, even though they don't, like, show a recession in their path of GDP growth rates in the CBO economic forecast. They essentially kind of average in the fact that we know that sometime over the next 10 years, probably within the next 2 or 3 years, there's going to be another recession. So CBO's growth rates are always going to tend to be to look a little bit muted, just because they need to build in the expectation that there will be a recession sometime in the next few years. And I can tell you that the administration's growth rate numbers are not consistent with kind of building in an average recession, averaging the effect of a recession over the budget window.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and economist Diane Lim in our recurring segment, The Economist Mom. We're discussing President Trump's fiscal year 2020 budget proposal. And Bob, you mentioned some of the potential cuts that would come in a proposal like this, and certain increases in spending and extending the tax cuts from 2017 and making many of those provisions permanent. From maybe, and Diane, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this as well. What kind of priorities would a proposal like this communicate to Congress? Like, what does the president apparently view as the number one priority moving forward for our country?
Well, I think defense spending certainly gets a high priority in the budget, probably over any other category of federal spending, particularly in the short term. I mean, let me illustrate that by saying that the, you know, what their the defense budget is scheduled for about a 10% cut under this budget law that was enacted a few years ago. These caps that go into effect this year. It's a long, complicated story, but just take it for granted that the defense budget is under current law supposed to get about an 11% cut this year. So the president says, no, we can't do that. Let's not honor that cap. Let's raise it and even add another 5% onto that. And that's a pretty, you know, that's a pretty generous increase, except that the president is doing it under a gimmicky way of doing it, by putting the new money into this overseas contingency account. It's called OCO, and it's not exempt. It is exempt from the caps. So the OCO account, which is supposed to be for war funding, and all presidents have used it in a gimmicky way to fund what they really want to spend on base Pentagon spending. So a little, you know, it's always been kind of an outlet to get a little bit of an extra boost for the Pentagon budget by calling it war spending. And a lot of us have complained about it as a gimmick for years. In fact, one of the most vocal critics was Mick Mulvaney, the current acting chief of staff when he was in the Congress. He used to rail against this when Obama was doing it. But so this OCO gimmick, the OCO account right now last year was $69 billion. Just remember that, $69 billion. The president is asking for OCO designation for defense spending this coming year of $165 billion. So it's like more than doubling this OCO, this special account that's above the caps and exempt from caps. And they're not making any pretense that this is just a budget gimmick. They're not saying, oh, we need this because, you know, we're going to go to war or something. This is rivaling, in fact, the size of the OCO budget when we did have a full force in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're just saying, no, this is the way we get around the cap. We call it OCO, and then we don't have to raise the cap. And we say we're sticking with the caps, and then we don't have to make a deal with the Democrats to raise the non-defense cap. So we'll stick it in the OCO budget. So that's really the game here. It's obviously it can't work because the Democrats would have to go along with it to enact appropriations bills. So it's a real sleight of hand. But it does demonstrate the extent to which defense spending is the priority of the budget.
So I would say, yes, defense spending is a big priority in the budget in terms of new proposals out there, new spending that's out there. But there's also tax cuts are a big priority. It's just that tax cuts don't look like a big priority in the budget because they're not considered a new proposal. But if you actually consider the cost of extending the tax cuts, relative to what's actually in current law, it's a big ticket item in the president's budget.
And one thing neither of you mentioned, which I was a little surprised by, was the increased funding for a border wall, and how I think from my perspective, it's obviously a high priority for the president. And I wonder, and this is my question for the two of you, how much of a sticking point will that be for the 2020 process?
My answer to that is that, first, remember, it's a very, very small amount of money. So
yeah.
I think Diane and I would tend to look at that and talking about priorities and looking at much bigger numbers than budgetarily, that's wallowing in the weeds. But you're right that
politically
it's an enormous thing.
Sticking point, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe the most salient point of the budget in terms of its real-life impact. And what it portends is another shutdown. I mean, I think you can kind of book it to have a shutdown by sometime, September 30th at the end of the fiscal year, because we're just going to replay the whole thing, except this time with the entire budget at stake, because the president is obviously going to hold out for full border wall funding because he thinks it works for him politically, and let's say that he actually believes that this is good policy, and he's certainly willing to shut down the government over it. So I think that it's going to be I think it's very unlikely that any of the appropriations bills are going to get passed on time. And because they're all going to be fighting in some way or another about these numbers. And look, the Democrats may try to prevent border wall funding in all of their appropriations bills. Since the president declared an emergency, if I were the Democrats, I'd be a little bit worried that he might go after pots of money just about anywhere in the government. So, they may start putting conditions on all the appropriations bills that say, none of the funds appropriated herein shall be, used for construction of a border wall. And, of course, the president wouldn't sign any such bills. So that just further makes me think that we're going to have a shutdown. And let me just throw in, to add to this scary scenario, is that this year we're going to have a debt limit problem as well, because the debt limit has been revived. It's going to have to be raised or suspended somewhere before the end of the year, probably. So that's going to get thrown into the mix, too. So I think we are in for a very, very problematic and toxic appropriations season this fall.
And, Bob, you alluded to this earlier, and that was new spending caps that will go into place for discretionary spending. From your view, will Congress have to come to an agreement on new limits before they really get far down the road in the appropriations process, or is that something they can address along the way?
Well, they're going to, if they don't want to abide by those new tough caps, yes, they're going to have to come to an agreement, which they've done three times before. These caps went into effect in 2011 and in various stages since then, they've made a budget deal that Democrats and Republicans agreed to that raised the caps for a couple of years at a time. And so what's happened is the last cap increase has run out, and that's why the original caps go suddenly back into effect this year. And the difficulty this year is with this proposal, I think the president has sort of set a benchmark that he isn't going to agree anything that raises the non-defense caps. And if the Republicans in Congress follow his lead, and with the Democrats back in control of the House, this is why I think it's going to be very difficult to do a deal like they did before. And that's another reason why I think it's we're just like looking for a shutdown.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked a lot about discretionary spending and caps and priorities and that aspect of the budget. Does this proposal from the president address any mandatory spending like Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid?
Yes, it does. I think that those are the parts of the budget that are really dead on arrival. I don't think you have the willingness. Certainly the Democrats will talk about it to make it sound like they're throwing people under the old people and poor people into the streets. And the Republicans have no interest in taking up entitlement reform. Right. So I don't
cutting Medicare.
Is there anything in the budget that, you know, extends an olive branch toward anything bipartisan? And, you know, we've laughingly talked about in the past how spending more money has been a bipartisan effort. But is there anything in terms of reform or addressing certain issues that does have sort of that tone of bipartisanship with it?
Oh, there are a couple of things. There's the same number that they had last year for an infrastructure bill, which is $199 billion, so call it $200. And there's a proposal for a parental leave, something for parental leave.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a couple of things. I'm not really looking for major progress on either one, just because politically speaking, I think both sides are interested in highlighting points of differences.
The political season is not the right one for reaching out in terms of bipartisanship. It's more the time to throw barbs at each other, right?
Do you think there's any, and certainly it would, well, maybe not certainly, but it would probably be political suicide to take this sort of angle with a budget proposal if you're the president. But would you like to see a president's budget proposal do that sort of thing, extend the olive branch, be more bipartisan, be more realistic in the numbers? And before you laugh at me and say, yes, of course, thinking about the political ramifications and sort of the trajectory we're on fiscally, I'm of the perspective that I'd like to see the grown-ups in the room talk about these issues. What do you think?
Well, of course, but I don't think it's going to come from a president's budget. I think that those efforts have to start in a bipartisan way in Congress, and we've had efforts like that before. But I don't know. Have there been past presidential budgets, Bob, that were like saying, I think they were more bipartisan in the past, but I'm just wondering, were there ever like serious bipartisan proposals that were part of the president's budget?
I don't know. Normally the president puts out the budget, and then if there's a interest in doing something in a bipartisan way, there's kind of a follow-up.
Right. They're working with Congress, and they're, you know.
This is not one of those budgets.
No.
If you want to do that, what you do is put out a budget that's relatively vague, doesn't have a lot of, landmines in it or poison pills in it. And then you say, this is my proposal, and, you know, we're willing to talk to the other side, and you invite the congressional leaders up to the White House or something to have a discussion. This is more an in-your-face budget. This is what I want. It's all of what I want. It's what I want in an exaggerated form, and try and stop me. It's not presented in the manner that would make you think it was going to lead to some sort of follow-up. Now, look, the president was calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and calling him names and fatso and things, and then he says he's fallen in love with him. So who knows? He may invite Nancy Pelosi up to the, he may fall in love with Nancy Pelosi. I don't know.
So given the sort of unpredictable nature of what we're experiencing right now, especially in this process, What would you anticipate as next steps for fiscal year 2020 and the appropriations process? Is it, you know, proposals coming from the House and Senate, some kind of bipartisan agreement?
Yeah.
What do you see as coming around the corner?
I mean, I'm not that pessimistic about Congress being able to come up with some bipartisan ideas. I just think that they're not going to get inspiration from the president's budget. But I would think that they're not going to pay very much attention to the president's proposals in this budget. But they're going to keep trying to work together. I mean, it is at least the case that we have the House and Senate controlled by the opposite parties, and that tends to force at least some greater degree of bipartisanship than when one party controls both houses. So, you know, to get things done, things have to pass both the House and the Senate. And so I think that that necessitates some greater cooperation and collaboration among the members of Congress, even if they don't have the president coming along for that effort. They're going to have to work together to some extent, because they've got decisions that have to be made, policies that have to be acted upon within the next year.
There used to be something quaint called a budget resolution that the House and the Senate would each do, and then they'd compromise and come up with a budget resolution. And when both Diane and I were first working in this field, the budget resolution was an absolute must. You did the budget resolution every year. And now Congress has gotten into the habit of not doing a budget resolution because they can't make any compromises. And they can't make the numbers work without compromise, so they just don't bother doing a budget resolution, which I think is one of the most lamentable problems in the last few years. So the next step should be the House and the Senate would each pass a budget resolution, and then they would reconcile them and have a joint budget resolution, which would determine the appropriations numbers for all the bills and any mandatory spending or revenue changes they wanted to make. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen. The House may not even do a budget resolution, I'm hearing now, and because they can't quite figure out, they don't want to highlight differences within the caucus. So you could have the next step will be trying to get the House and Senate together on some sort of number for the appropriations bills. And I agree with Diane. If you just left the Congress to their own, just on their own, I think it would be much easier for them to do that. It will be more difficult with the president insisting on this budget proposal. And the key is, if you're going to watch anything, Mitch McConnell, because he could say to his appropriators in the Senate on the Republican side, you know, let's make a deal. We're going to tell the president this is the way it is. But last year, as you remember, on the border wall, McConnell pretty much said, you know, we're not going to do anything unless the president approves of it. So that gives the president kind of a virtual veto power. And that will make that could, if that's what happens, make it very, very difficult to get anything done.
So it sounds like we have a lot of work to do, especially when it comes to getting bipartisan agreement on some really important things like the debt limit and spending levels and even a budget resolution. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during the Economist Mom segment. We've been discussing President Trump's fiscal year 2020 budget proposal. Thank you both for joining the show once again.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. It's important to distinguish between short-term cyclical deficits and long-term structural deficits. With the 2020 presidential election cycle in full swing, with candidates discussing their plans and proposals, and the president's fiscal year 2020 budget proposal finally out, it's a good time for a reminder. Not all deficits are created equal. In designing policy responses, it's important to distinguish between, quote, cyclical and, quote, structural deficits. Cyclical deficits are largely caused by changes in the economy. Recessions drive down government revenue,
because many workers and businesses are no longer earning as much taxable income. At the same time, government spending rises because more people need assistance through programs such as Medicaid, unemployment benefits, or food stamps. In budget terms, such programs are known as automatic stabilizers because they help to maintain demand in an economy that does not have enough of it to keep going. These automatic stabilizers usually produce a temporary or cyclical increase in deficits. Once the economy recovers, tax revenue and government spending on assistance programs should return to normal levels. If government spending exceeds tax revenue, however, even when the economy is strong, as we're seeing now, then the deficit is structural. Unlike cyclical deficits, structural deficits reflect a chronic problem that must be addressed through significant changes in tax and spending policies. That is especially the case right now, with the CBO projecting budget deficits of $11.6 trillion over the next 10 years. And the most effective policy changes are those impacting permanent law, such as mandatory spending programs and tax provisions. With structural deficits, one-time spending cuts or temporary tax increases may help to relieve the pressure, but can't on their own solve the long-term problems. For example, following the 2008 financial crisis, deficits skyrocketed for cyclical reasons. Deficits were further increased by stimulus measures in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that Congress passed in 2009. By the end of fiscal year 2010, when cyclical deficits reached their peak, the total deficit had swelled to $1.3 trillion, up from $248 billion in 2006. The public, increasingly alarmed, imagine that, demanded that policymakers act to curb these deficits. And while this was a natural reaction, there was a sound economic case for the higher deficits. Well-targeted deficits designed to stimulate an economy in freefall can benefit the country's economic health both in the short and long term, because a shrinking economy leads to a higher debt-to-GDP ratio even when the budget is balanced. In fiscal year 2010, over half of the deficit was due to stimulus measures that would dissipate as the economy recovered. The real problem has always been over the long term. A temporary spike in deficits to combat a short-term national emergency is reasonable. But a national debt that consistently grows faster than even a healthy economy is not sustainable. And that's exactly what's happening. Our total national debt now exceeds $22 trillion. Our publicly held debt is the highest that it's been as a percentage of the economy since the World War II era, and we're projected to go from its current level of 78% of GDP to over 93% of the economy within 10 years. As the economy recovered from the Great Recession, policymakers should have put more focus on addressing the drivers of the nation's structural deficit. Instead, the vast majority of deficit reduction legislation passed in the years since the recession has been concentrated on the parts of the budget that were already shrinking relative to the size of the economy. Even assuming a strong economy with no cyclical deficit, current policies will mean structural deficits and a steadily rising debt-to-GDP ratio for as far as the eye can see. Eventually, the debt burden, or the cost of servicing that debt, will become too great to bear. And although it's impossible to say exactly when that would happen, it would be foolish to risk finding out. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.